This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Supply chains, as we have known them, have been reshaped by the responses to living with COVID-19. The changes are still unfolding as circumstances keep changing, and the ripple effect for years to come is only beginning to be felt. Here in the Chattanooga area, we hold a unique position in the supply chain business with unique perspectives to match, including on our own campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Enrique Visoso is a supply chain consultant with more than 30 years in the manufacturing and logistics industry, and he is involved with the supply chain program here at UTC. Matthew Williams is supply chain manager for Southern Champion Tray, responsible for distribution and transportation. And Paul Newborn is a former executive vice president for Covenant Transport Solutions with an extensive career in transportation. He now works as a logistics project consultant. Matthew, Enrique, Paul, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
Glad to be here today.
Enrique, we should start by telling folks more about the supply chain program.
I've been working with John Fries, who is a director of the Center for Professional Education at UTC, not for a couple of years. When we first got together in 2017, John realized supply chain is an incredibly fascinating and vital field, and we knew there was a component of continuing education. We got together a number of local leaders, manufacturing, distribution leaders, and we talked to them about what do they need? How could CPE help them? And we came out with dual goals. One is we needed to foster networking of supply chain professionals, but obviously also then for CPE was education and best practices. Out of that grew a program of what is now monthly lunch and learn events. Back before the virus, we actually get together and break bread, and we would have a speaker that would share some best practices and information. Now we do those events online, and we get about 30 to 40 participants every month. Those lunch and learn events, one of the things we did in 2018 is we partnered with the Chattanooga Regional Manufacturers Association, and they've been an incredible partner in which we've really fostered the networking piece as well as the educational piece. And then in 2019, on the educational side, CPE started running courses for preparation and certification of supply chain and production and inventory management certifications. If you've heard of APEX, the Association for Supply Chain Management, they provide certifications on those two fields, production inventory management and supply chain. So last year, we started running courses to help people prepare for those certifications. And we actually have our next course is starting next month in August for the supply chain professional certification.
Of course, all of this foundation was laid before COVID-19. And when we're talking about COVID-19 these days, one of the many things that has been affected by the pandemic, continues to be affected, are supply chains. Matthew and Paul, how do you see the COVID-19 situation impacting transportation capacity at this time?
From our perspective here at Southern Champion, and we run a private fleet of trucks, so we currently have 21 over-the-road truck drivers covering between 2,300 and 3,000 miles a week. It has impacted the actual driver as far as capacity. So far, we have not noticed a big decrease in capacity on the trucking side. However, I anticipate as we move into the end of the year and in fourth quarter that that will likely experience that with a tightening in the trucking market.
From my standpoint, I've seen a couple of things. There was an incredible amount of what I'll call seesaw demand at the onset as sort of people began to shut down or try to operate partially, and people shifted from working in an office to working at home. And that resulted in some flow changes, particularly in the consumer goods and the food and beverage industry. So you have this ebb and flow. And so you saw rates sort of crater as freight disappeared and there was a lot of capacity. All along sort of running in the background is, you know, insurance renewals, which are up about 30% this year for most carriers. So you've got the squeeze of less business. You have the squeeze of less productivity because as shippers and receivers implemented new protocols for sanitation, it took longer to get loaded or to get unloaded in many cases. And so you had all these negative productivity factors, which I don't believe we're seeing the full extent of the impact yet, to Matthew's point. But I think in the next couple of probably 60 to 90 days, particularly if openings continue to rebound. Now, if we see the secondary hotspots sort of retrenchment and we go back to shutdowns, you'll see a drop off in demand and there may be sufficient capacity for the interim. But again, in the background, I think you're going to see smaller and smaller mid-sized carriers having difficulty staying in business as they sort of work their way through this. We are seeing spot market rates sort of work their way up, particularly on the reefer side right now. Again, because things are starting back up and freight's starting to move, some of the carriers, particularly on the refrigerated side, are still on the sidelines or have exited. So from that standpoint, we're sort of treading water right now. But I would expect in the next 60 to 90 days, particularly if the reopenings continue, that things will get tight going into the back half of the year.
And we're no strangers to being a hotspot here in the Chattanooga area. What about warehouse capacity? What about warehouse operations?
That's been a big issue for us. Warehouse space for us right now, our warehousing and our capacity that we're facing is we're as full now as we have been in probably the last 12 months. When I look at our working capacity, we're extremely tight. And what I would attribute that to is the changes that we've seen in the items that we actually manufacture and sell. Forecasts right now on certain items are through the roof. Items where we had built inventory, an example would be a food tray, which would be very popular at ballparks right now and summer picnics. All the things that people aren't doing, we're carrying inventory on those items. So it's really challenged us in our warehouse storage.
If you consider those sorts of implications and then the fact that there's been this huge spike in e-commerce and that sort of shifted where product has had to be, and many manufacturers have responded by trying to forward position more inventory. But it doesn't matter what temperature class, ambient, temperature control, or frozen, most warehouses are pretty full. In fact, there's been some activity lately with real estate companies trying to repurpose retail space, which is no longer needed because companies have sort of exited the retail market, to see if they can position those as interim storage facilities that are closer to market, which will help facilitate the delivery aspect of e-commerce. Just in general, the market for warehousing had been tightening. It was really just in the last 6 months or so that you've seen more new projects break ground. And even those projects, a lot of that was already pre-committed space. In general, the market is pretty tight right now.
Matthew, you touched on the shift in manufacturing operations. How about what we call last mile logistics operations?
Also been challenging. Just the whole delivery aspect of that final delivery has become challenging with all the different protocols in place. As receivers are challenged on their end, shippers are facing challenges as well. But the last mile for us, especially on the smaller deliveries, has definitely been impacted by COVID-19.
Think about the breadth of products now that people are ordering online. Furniture, as well as consumer product goods, as well as home delivery of prepared food. It's really had an impact on putting stress on the local delivery networks. There's not one of those companies that isn't looking for drivers to try to facilitate meeting the demand. And then of course, as your products get bigger, that's a different type of carrier typically, because you don't necessarily put a couch in your pickup truck and deliver it to someone versus delivering another product. I read the other day that UPS is actually looking at their mix of business, and they have a fair amount of business that they're not sure they really want because they're having to deal with this surge of volume. And then you have people like Amazon who are working to try to hire people to facilitate the delivery. So I think the last mile will continue to be affected by e-commerce because I believe a significant amount of that business is likely to stay in place after this pandemic is over. People get comfortable. Hey, you know what? I don't have to go to the grocery store. I don't have to go to the Target to get my detergent or the Costco to get my case of drinks. I can get that delivered. And of course, most of these retailers are offering free delivery, quote unquote, if you spend a certain amount. So that's going to continue to put demand on those services, and that's going to continue to require drivers and vehicle capacity in order to meet those demands. And then as larger items continue to be popular in terms of home delivery, you're going to see an evolution of the vehicle and the driver and the service that's required to do the, I'll call it the white glove delivery of those types of items?
Just to get a sense of magnitude, e-commerce demand is about 70-80% year over year, a 70-80% increase. That spike started in March. So the growth really has been significant. Obviously, the brick and mortar retail sales suffered, and those have somewhat come back. But that e-commerce spike, when you talk about 70-80% year to year, it's a big jump, and it really drives a lot of adjustments throughout the entire supply chain.
What does that mean for drivers? What does that mean for interviewing drivers, for training them, for onboarding them, given these changing conditions and the ongoing uncertainty with public health and varying from jurisdiction to jurisdiction?
My take on the driver, the over-the-road driver, and the impact of COVID-19, it's made a very hard job even more difficult, if that's possible. So if you just look at the life of a driver and being out on the road during this time, it's already challenging under normal conditions, but even more so now, with all the protocols in place, they have less opportunity for hot meals and ability to get showers, places to stay overnight. So just the challenges for a driver being out on the road right now, they're real. And so we have drivers that are facing that every day. If you look at these guys and these men and women and what they're doing, I consider them, a lot of them are kind of like the last American cowboys. They're really getting after it and getting it done. We're very proud of the drivers that we have here. Bigger challenge, it's a tough field, even under the best of conditions, not a lot of folks looking to become professional drivers. Just the home time piece of it is huge. And now with the virus on top of it, my guess is that less people will be attracted to this industry, unfortunately.
If you think about what these folks are stuck with now, more demand from their companies to drive longer and stay away from home longer. And then if they go home, they have the risk that either they could bring the virus back or they could pick it up at home. I heard the other day that one of the major carriers had up to 25% of their drivers had tested positive and were in some various state of dealing with the virus. Imagine if you're a trucking company and you lose 25% of your driver force because they're sick. It has all kinds of implications, not only on your own productivity and profitability, but on your ability to service your customers' requirements going forward. And Matthew's points about, you know, hot meals and showers and clean and safe environments for those drivers to harbor, they get reduced. And most shippers and receivers now really don't want the drivers, even more than before, to sort of hang out at their facilities. And the drivers have less opportunity to use rest facilities at these sites now because of concerns about COVID. So it's a tough job. And I agree with Matthew. If you see a truck driver, you should thank them because they're doing an extraordinary job to keep goods moving.
The work at home response brought on by COVID-19 has already impacted logistics activity in ways that could not have been imagined before the pandemic. How do you see future logistics activity being impacted further? And how will the COVID-19 experience going forward influence what's known as continuity planning within the supply chain business?
We have a lot of people here now working at home, a lot. I'll have to be honest with you, it has far exceeded my expectations on how well it has worked. I'm really surprised. Not surprised with our people. I know we got great people, but I just thought not having that daily touch point, being away from each other, had some concerns. But it's been a game changer, and I think it's a forever game changer. So it'll be interesting to see what this looks like once we get to the other side of this deal. I think that probably some of these folks probably don't find their way back to the office. The silver lining in all of this, I have seen that it has actually expedited our ability to make tough decisions. We've had to be a lot more nimble. You don't have as much time to think things through. So in that part of it, I can see where, you know, we've learned to pivot faster. Having people at home was a quick pivot, but it's worked out exceedingly well. Be interesting to see when we get to the other side what it looks like. But my guess is we'll stay in some form of this arrangement. I don't know if it'll be to this degree, but I don't think it's going away.
I think Matthew is spot on. I think his company's experience is going to be reflected across many, even those who doubted the work-at-home options, which is something that the younger generation has been asking for the last several years, is to have that option. I think it's now viable because everybody has proven, hey, it can work. That's going to lead companies to reevaluate their on-site work requirements. I think roles are going to evolve and morph to allow more people to work at home. That's going to lead to companies saying, gee, I don't need the office space that I have. As I mentioned earlier, real estate companies are starting to repurpose retail space. Pretty soon they'll look to repurpose office space because it's going to be available. So I think it's going to be a challenging time for those in commercial real estate. There will also be, I'll call it downstream collateral effects. Think about it. If you have an office and you have 100 people there and you're in a downtown area, every day 100 people go to work. They stop and buy coffee. They go out at lunchtime. Maybe they stop for a drink after work. That changes. And so any of those support businesses, restaurants, C-stores, those sorts of businesses that benefit from a work commuting environment are going to be affected. And that's going to affect their demand. It's going to then have an upstream impact on warehousing requirements, transportation needs, as well as the viability of those businesses. And that will force companies to reevaluate portions of their supply chains to make sure that they can make the appropriate adjustment. And as Matthew mentioned, be nimble to make sure that they're staying current and keeping their business in a highly productive, profitable situation.
Manufacturers have some tough decisions to come. You know, on the sourcing supply side, when you have one source, one company to source your raw materials, it gets really tough. And obviously the whole China thing brings in another curveball. People tend to think in terms of developing multiple sources as, you know, just get two or three sources. It's just really not. It's not as easy as it sounds. It's really difficult. So they're going to have to really make assessments. Am I going to allow this virus to completely upend my sourcing strategy, or do I need to in some other way attain agility and flexibility? And on the downstream side, let me just one very brief example, chicken. You would think supplying chicken to restaurants and supplying chicken to grocery stores. Well, I'm not going to the restaurant, but I'm going to the grocery store. So just chicken, go to the grocery store. Well, it's not that easy. The supply chain for restaurants and the supply chain for grocery stores is completely different. The packaging, the processing. Many chicken processors do not have dual ability. So do they spend hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars on equipment so they can supply either channel? Some tough decisions.
You're also going to see companies that had business continuity plans sit down, look them over and say, okay, what worked? What could we make better? And those companies, and unfortunately there are more out there than we'd like to think, those without plans are going to sit down and say, we need a robust continuity planning system and protocol. And that will lead to periodic testing of those plans so that the next time something like this happens, which most folks are saying there will be another bug that we don't have a cure for, people will be in a better shape to deal with the aftermath and the implications from a pandemic. So from that standpoint, I think you're going to see lots of activity. And if you happen to be in that business of helping people with business continuity planning, I think you'll be very busy. I think also there's going to be a lot of discussion about reshoring or onshoring certain activity for certain aspects of the industry, particularly in the medical community around medicines and PPE, which may then impact how you contingency plan once you've moved the manufacturing process back into a domestic situation. So lots of changes coming for sure.
Enrique, where can people go online to participate in and keep up to date with the supply chain program at UTC?
utc.edu/CPE. There's a link to a very diverse range of programs that the Center for Professional Education fosters and promotes. You will see a link to the supply chain programs in that page. We do have, in October, we will have a risk planning workshop. So we're going to have a half a day workshop to hopefully help companies, as Paul said, many companies that don't have continuity risk planning, to be able to put together their risk management processes.
And we look forward to talking about that closer to then. Enrique, Matthew, Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ray. Appreciate it. Have a good one.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
I'm Will Davis, and this is Tennessee Valley StoryCorps. Stories from people who visited the StoryCorps mobile recording booth when it came to Chattanooga last year. Today, Edward Bergen talks to his partner, Catherine Kessler, about playing the accordion.
I remember going to the department stores in Boston, Massachusetts, and I remember distinctly going to Jordan's basement with my mother. They had these little, what were called Emini organs that were one octave in duration, with ran on 2D batteries. So I remember actually the first song I was playing, it was Mary Had a Little Lamb, but I did not know how to read music. And so I just figured out the keys with numbers. 3, 2, 1, 2, 3, 3, 3, 2, 2, 2, 3, 5, 5, 3, 2, 1, 2, 3, 3, 3, 2, 2, 3, 2, 1. I was in heaven.
How did you get started with the accordion?
Well, from the time I had that little Emini organ when I was, 4 years old or 5 years old, I always wanted to play the piano. But there was a music studio opened up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and it was accordion instruction and guitar instruction. So I figured that, well, the accordion, it has a keyboard, it looks like a piano. So I said, well, heck, I'll give it a shot. So back in February 2nd, actually, it was on my birthday in 1963, 56 years ago, that was my first accordion lesson. And 56 plus years later, I'm still playing it. You know, the accordion, actually, in the 1920s and 1930s, right up until the heyday, which was probably the early 1950s, shortly after I was born, was really that 30 or 40 year window was the heyday of accordion playing. And interestingly, it got a little bit of, I feel like, a bad rap in the late 1950s and early 1960s with the advent of rock and roll, first with Elvis and then with the Beatles. The bad rap, I thought, was that it was probably a little bit of a dorky instrument. But it is quite—it's quite a versatile instrument, and over the last 20 or 30 years, it's gotten quite a resurgence, not only in the United States but all across the world as well. And because of the kind of instrument it is, because of the nature of the instrument it is, how it's constructed, it lends itself to a lot of different styles of music. The accordion is basically a reed instrument, and it plays a lot of chord and chord accompaniments. But because of the construction of the instrument, it lends itself to playing all these different types of these sounds and genres quite easily.
What type of accordion is it?
Mine is a 120 bass piano accordion. It's a huge accordion. And actually, I have several other accordions as well, too. I have a smaller 120 bass accordion and a couple of other piano accordions and a couple of other button accordions. So I think I have 5 accordions in all.
How does music in general affect you when you listen to music?
Oh, I can listen to a piece of music, you know, and it can just bring a tear to my eye. It could be a wistful tear, a melancholy tear, a tear of sadness, a tear of joy. It's just something that it does. It's something probably quite primal. It just gets into my bones. It's in my heart. It's in every cell of my being. I'm sitting here just getting excited talking about it.
That was Catherine Kessler and Edward Bergen. This conversation, and others like it, are available online at wutc.org. And you can subscribe to the Tennessee Valley StoryCorps podcast wherever you get your podcasts. This series is produced and edited by me, Will Davis, and created at the Pod Lab at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga.
This is Scenic Roots. Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, and so the music comes from Barking Legs. In the course of a regular month, Barking Legs presents players from diverse backgrounds playing acoustic music or jazz several times a week. Every Wednesday evening, before the pandemic, they presented 2 hours of jazz in the lounge in the front of the building. Those sessions were online for a time until that began presenting its own set of challenges. It'll be back, but in the meantime, we have a sample of some of the music played in the lounge over the past couple of years. Bruce Kaplan, who curates many of the shows and all of the jazz at Barking Legs, is your host for these performances. Up first is bassist Dexter Bell and friends, drummer Yeti Westfield, pianist Marcus Dodson, guitarist James Blanton, and Karen McReynolds singing.
darling, please save your love for me. You can have fun with the crowd, but for crying out loud, darling, please save your love for me. Save your love for me.
We'd like to do a little Phyllis Hyman for you all tonight. What You Won't Do for Love. In my world, only you.
Nathan Warner is a trumpeter who has become familiar to attendees at our Wednesday Jazz in the Lounge. He's a fantastic player who moved to the area a few years ago from New York City. He got together with two other favorite musicians of ours, guitarist Sean Perkinson and the master of the saxophone, Alan Wyatt, and they recorded a tune which I think you'll find particularly apt listening for this time in our lives. So kick back and enjoy this wonderful trio, and we look forward to being able to welcome them back to the lounge before too long.
This heart of mine embraces all day through. In that small cafe, the park across the way, the children's carousel, the chestnut trees, they'll wish you well. Seeing you in every lovely summer's day, in everything that's light and gay, I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon. Seeing you. summer's day, in everything that's light and gay, I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon. But I'll be seeing you.
We have another favorite who unfortunately has left the area, and that is the formidable multi-instrumentalist Jose Valentino. Jose was in the area for maybe 3 years and appeared at Barking Legs several times. It was always a great evening. He is a virtuoso on tenor saxophone, flute, and electric bass, the latter being one that isn't typically associated with a reed player. I was in touch with Jose over the past week and said, do you have anything else that we haven't used that we could feature for our Wednesday Jazz Online? And he presented me with this recording done in our lounge. His quartet, which featured again Sean Perkinson on guitar and Robert Acevedo on drums and Japheth Farlack on bass, and they're going to be playing the John Coltrane classic Impressions. It's a beautiful recording, and I hope you enjoy it.
Oh, that was Jose Valentino playing the saxophone with Jacob Parlak playing bass, Sean Perkinson again playing the guitar, and the young drummer, Jose's mentee, Robert Escovedo, recorded in the lounge at Barking Legs in a halcyon time. One of the effects of the pandemic has been to create a kind of before and after perception of time and events, isn't it? Listening to those musicians playing so passionately before an audience in the relatively small space in the front of Barking Legs, affectionately referred to as the lounge, it does feel, at this point in time, as if that was another time, another life. But I think even the most pessimistic among us will probably agree that the performances in the lounge on Wednesday evenings will return sometime in the not-too-distant future. Bruce is still looking for a way to stream virtual performances in the lounge, but for now, we have a small archive to share with you here on Scenic Roots every Tuesday afternoon, live from Barking Legs on WUTC.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Thanks, as always, to our producers, Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, and Will Davis. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.